For June 8th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We are back again with the second half, the second part of our tale that we started yesterday, The Adventure of Wisteria Lodge. Boy, oh boy, is this an adventure.
This is a busy, busy story.
And a timely story.
Yes.
It turns out that we are reading this in the right time in U.S. history, for sure. We'll get to that as we get into this adventure. We get back to the investigation that Holmes and Watson are in. A cold and melancholy walk of a couple of miles brought us to a high wooden gate, which opened into a gloomy avenue of chestnuts. The curved and shadowed drive led us to a low, dark house, pitch black against a slate-colored sky. From the front window, upon the left of the door, there peeped a glimmer of feeble light.
Are they selling Visit England in this?
This is really creepy stuff going on in the beginning here.
Cold and melancholy. Sounds like a vacation.
We're really getting the gothic elements, right, that we'll see in Hound of the Baskervilles. Doyle is working on that angle. And then when we meet Walters, the constable who was left in charge of the mansion, he is pretty freaked out. And our new detective friend, Baines, tells him to pull himself together. And Walters is kind of upset. And you can feel it, I think, in his dialogue. I know, sir, I know. But it shook me, sir. And there's no use to deny it. It wasn't black, sir, nor was it white, nor any color that I know, but a kind of queer shade like clay with a splash of milk in it. Then there was the size of it. It was twice yours, sir. And the look of it, the great staring goggle eyes and the line of white teeth like a hungry beast. So he has seen a face at the window of this deserted mansion that absolutely has freaked this young man out.
And he's describing this face like an animal again, but the word face is in there, but not any kind of human quality.
Right.
I was confused at first that maybe we weren't even describing a human being here.
And he is confused by that too. And I think this brings up, remember that this story started with a question about what is the grotesque? That idea of something that you think is human but is not quite human, or that you think is, you know, symmetrical, but then you realize there's like a little asymmetry to it. So I think this is playing on that notion of the grotesque as an aesthetic movement, as well as a sort of anxiety-provoking gothic trope.
I think you just hit it right there. Because, you know, as notes we were putting together for the term grotesque, they use the term gargoyle. And the proper term is grotesque, not a gargoyle.
Right.
And if you think about their facial expressions as they hang off of a building, you know, spewing the water as it comes through, it's certainly this description that we have of this thing or person or whatever certainly falls into that thought process.
This being, we can't, sure. We're not even quite sure. And it's interesting that Holmes actually finds a size 12 shoe print outside the window. And so Holmes, the rational one, is like, okay, so this is an unusually large person. Okay, fair enough. You know, he's putting it into a rational worldview.
He hasn't met a modern American yet.
Of course.
Right. Size 12. That's kind of small. That's kind of snug.
The very small Holmes, who's just a smidge over 6 feet.
A massive man for his time.
We see here the relationship between Holmes and our new constable Baines, and very interesting conversations being had there.
And this is one of the few times where Holmes seems to really be pleased with his new colleague, Inspector Baines. He compliments the other man. He says, I must congratulate you, Inspector, on handling so distinctive and instructive a case. Your powers, if I may say so without offense, seem superior to your opportunities. Now, he's a country detective, right? So Holmes, coming out from the big city, is like, buddy, you're kind of lost out here in the boondocks, you know? We have like really cool cases in London that you might be able to work on.
So is he being straight with this guy, or he is?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I think so.
You think so?
I
don't know. As I'm reading it, I'm going, okay, I read it the other way, that he was kind of mocking him a little bit.
I don't think so. I think that he is being genuine here, and I think that Baines proves himself through this case, and Holmes is very pleased with Baines throughout.
Do we have the part where he goes, well, you have your ways, and I have my ways? And
yeah.
And I think it's interesting because Baines says, listen, let's pursue our own theories separate from each other. And it's not because he doesn't believe that Holmes knows what he's doing. He totally does believe it. But he says, I should be glad to be able to say afterwards that I had solved it without your help. So he's a young man who wants to prove himself. And this is in complete contrast to the six Napoleons. Do you guys remember when Lestrade is like, oh, Holmes, you're so crazy. And Holmes is like, oh, well, if you think so, you do your thing, I'll do mine. And then Lestrade ends up pursuing the Italian connection and just ignoring all the facts. Remember this from Six mm-hmm. Napoleons?
Yes, I do.
And so here, Holmes and Baines end up going about it in different ways, but coming to the same conclusion, which demonstrates that Holmes was right to think Baines was a smart guy.
At about the same time, they come to the same conclusion, and Baines is up in a tree watching Sherlock looking at the same situation at the same time. That's
a great scene.
Yeah. Baines seems to be holding a man on suspicions that have no evidence behind them. They found this guy coming back to the scene of the crime, and Baines arrested him, but he says, I don't know that I have any evidence here. Holmes asks him, and you think you have evidence that he murdered his late master? And Baines replies, I didn't say so, Mr. Holmes. I didn't say so. We all have our little ways. You try yours, and I will try mine. That's the agreement. Sherlock says, there's something in Inspector Baines which I can't quite understand. He's trying to figure out this guy who has arrested a suspect but has no evidence behind that arrest.
Well, and I'm just using today's terms. Wasn't this kind of profiling?
Yes, this is certainly a person in the situation who could have been a suspect, but without any evidence other than the race of person that this man is. That's a slippery slope right here, my friend.
Oh, I think this entire story deals a lot with, like I said, very timely issues.
A lot of assumptions about people based on their country of birth, their race, and their gender in this one, over sure. and over again.
And if I can go back to Baines and Holmes for a second, I think when Holmes says there's something I can't quite understand, I'm thinking, look in the mirror, buddy. How many times have we heard Holmes say to Lestrade or Gregson, oh, you know, I have my little ways. Why don't you do your thing and I'll do mine? So Baines is, in a way, he is actually using the same language that Holmes uses to say, like, don't worry, I've got a plan. I'm not just racial profiling here. I actually have a plan. And the plan to make someone think you have someone in custody is the exact same plan that Holmes used in the Six Napoleons, right? He went to the journalist and was like, let people know we found the culprit. Because he doesn't want the real culprit to feel like they're still looking for him. So there's a lot in common with Six Napoleons, and Baines is learning from the master, Sherlock Holmes.
Holmes re-explains to Watson that Garcia invited Scott Eccles to his home to act as an alibi. Remember that from part one, everyone? Hey, remember Scott Eccles? He's a part of this story. Garcia was planning some kind of crime, and his household was probably involved, which is why they've all disappeared. Watson explains, the whole inexplicable tangle seemed to be straightened out before me. I wondered, as I always did, how it had not been obvious to me before. There's a lot of relationship between Holmes and Watson here, and this idea of the part two where Doyle feels like he has to explain, oh yeah, remember part one, here's where we're at. They're talking about the letter from part one here too, and they know that the handwriting belongs to a woman, right?
Now, of course, I was like, can you really tell if handwriting belongs to a man or a woman? So with that in mind, I just started doing a little bit of research, and I found a study from the Journal of Statistics Education where they did this large-scale research of having people guess gender from handwriting sample. Now, this was from 2015, and wow, people are pretty poor at guessing gender from handwriting, like approximately 60% accuracy, which just barely beats chance. However, in the 19th century, I found from another article from Brill, there was a lot more differences between handwriting and, interestingly, linguistic choices that men and women made. So based on education, people did actually write quite differently based on how we taught girls versus taught boys to write. So it seemed like a little bit like, huh, how would you know? But within the context of the 19th century and the education system, it is actually quite possible that you could tell a person's gender with fairly good accuracy based on their handwriting.
And for our young listeners who may not know even what handwriting is.
It's when you take out a thing and scribble shapes onto a piece of dead tree and hand it in. That's how we used to do things, kids. Back in my day.
Back in my day, we moved from crayons to these things called pencils and pens.
giant eye, man doing this. Holmes has been looking for the largest house in the area, which may contain our next clues. We talked about this in part one. There's something about seven rooms, and therefore must be a large house. He finds a large house in the area called High Gable, and Mr. Henderson, who is the owner of that property, is very suspicious indeed.
Now, when they go to that property, they find out that Miss Burnett is the governess, and she's the only woman in the Henderson household. Now, I really loved this part. At any rate, says Holmes, we may take it as a hypothesis and see what consequence it would entail. I may add that Miss Burnett's age and character make it certain that my first idea that there might be a love interest in our story is out of the question. My goodness, Miss Burnett, I don't want to tell you, is 40 years old, therefore far too old for love.
Oh, Steve.
Clearly, no one's ever committed any crimes around such an ancient old maid.
Yes, those are the type of things to bring up at the Thanksgiving meal and just watch, like, you know, my mother just maybe slap me across the head and say, what are you talking about?
And she's discounted so quickly in this that we don't even get a description of what she looks like until later on when she's in real peril, where her description is...
I mean, women of 40, they just look like nothing, right?
Yeah, right. Just invisible. Middle-aged women, just invisible. Yes. Amazing, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness. That certainly is an interesting statement, Mr. Doyle.
Another one. Thank you. Holmes suggests they go to High Gable in the night and climb an outhouse to reach the window of Miss Burnett, the only woman in the area who might be of suspicion in this case.
Why was that set up for Abbott and Costello to play, to have that scene?
We don't actually get to that scene. It doesn't actually happen, but the idea of it, finally, we get Watson confessing that he's uneasy in this scheme.
And I love what he says. The old house with its atmosphere of murder, the singular and formidable inhabitants, the unknown dangers of the approach, and the fact that we were putting ourselves legally in a false position, all combined to damp my ardor. And I just thought, oh, young Watson, he's so sweet. Because 8 years later, he's going to strap on his pistol and happily accompany his best friend to the house of Charles Augustus Milverton, where they're going to hang out holding hands behind the curtain and watch Milverton killed. I mean, there's a quite remarkable difference between Watsons, right?
Oh, the growth that he had.
The character arc.
he's sharing this with the audience, but not with Holmes. He does not say this out loud. This is just a thought that he's giving us, the reader, that maybe that would be a little too illegal, my friend Holmes.
Although I will do it, but I'm not feeling great about it.
I want to protest, but I'm not going to actually act up. That's right.
I'll write it down. Before their plan is put into motion, Warner, the gardener of High Gable, who was recently fired, informs them that the residents of High Gable fled. Miss Barnett ran away from them as the rest got away on a train. In the cab was a woman, half collapsed from nervous exhaustion. She bore upon her aquiline and emaciated face the traces of some recent tragedy. Her head hung listlessly upon her breast, but as she raised it and turned her dull eyes upon us, I saw that her pupils were dark dots in the center of the broad gray iris. She was drugged with opium.
Dun, dun, dun.
But all you have to do is give her some coffee and she'll be fine and tell you a really horrifying story.
So is it sexist not to offer her brandy and soda?
She wasn't fainting. She was drugged. She needed
That's why you need caffeine. The caffeine.
Yes. There's a liquid for everything in Doyle. Beverages help. Henderson is a well-known criminal boss named Don Murillo, the Tiger of San Pedro, a Central American dictator of a fictional country here.
Now, is he the original Tiger King?
I think so, yes.
Yes.
Wow, we got quite a ways into this episode without mentioning the Tiger King. Kind of impressed, Chip.
Well, he's kind of like the Joe Exotic of his time. You know, you never know.
We will never know because we will never watch that program. Miss Barnett has been undercover. She's working for a group seeking revenge upon Murillo for his many crimes. He's got plenty of enemies who wanted to see him pay for his crimes. She becomes the children's governess to keep tabs on him and to send word of his whereabouts to that group. The late Garcia was the son of a dignitary from San Pedro. Murillo killed Garcia so that, quote, the pursuit might cease, since such a death might frighten others from the task. This is a bad, bad man.
Oh, yeah.
And Miss Burnett, of no particular interest to anyone for love, is a very, very strong woman, right? So she has actually shown remarkable resiliency, remarkable bravery in going undercover like this. She's really had like horrible torture for like 5 days. It's a pretty rough scene. And I think she does come out of it as a really powerful character.
Yeah. Beaten and tortured for 5 days. The cruelty is just stunning here. And then at the end, they drug her to get her out of the house. This is some dark stuff from Doyle here.
Yes.
I agree.
But then in the end, after, so now she has been saved from this situation. Mm-hmm. And Baines, our inspector from the country, gets a gold star for deceiving the criminal, actually being on the same page as Holmes. And we actually get, you know, Holmes again complimenting him. "You'll rise high in your profession. You have instinct and intuition," said Holmes. Baines flushed with pleasure. Now, I am very intrigued by the fact that as we're wrapping up the case, Baines seems to represent a kind of optimism that Holmes and Watson don't necessarily share. So near the end, "Our difficulties are not over," Holmes remarked, shaking his head. "Our police work ends, but our legal work begins." "Exactly," said I. "A plausible lawyer could make it out as an act of self-defense. There may be 100 crimes in the background, but it is on this one that they can be tried." So Watson and Holmes are thinking, you know, sure enough, the Tiger of San Pedro did kill Garcia, but only when Garcia was, you know, doing an assassination attempt. Mm-hmm. So this horrible dictator who has tortured the lovely Miss Barnett, he might actually get away with it. "Come, come," said Baines cheerily. "I think better of the law than that." Mm. And I'm kind of intrigued by that because I'm thinking, like Baines is really represented in super positive ways here. He's a young man who understands detective work, who knows how to take mentorship from the great Sherlock Holmes, but also how to be independent and make his own way. He's not young Stanley Hopkins, who just like bows down to Holmes and is like, please teach me, sir. He's like a lot more independent spirited than that, right? But what about that optimism? Do you guys think that the law is going to come down on what Watson and Holmes would think the right side? Do you think he's an optimist, a realist? It maybe depends on the reader's view, because correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think Doyle ever tells us what happens to the Tiger of San Pedro in this story.
Yeah, he does meet his comeuppance. We do get a comeuppance for him.
But not from the
law. Does it have sardine oil involved?
Yeah, there's sardine oil involved. Yeah, the law, believing that the law will take care of a despot like this, a real leader of real crimes, history does not show us that the law is going to take care of this. It's groups of people like we're described here that take care of such a situation most often. That is some great optimism that I think Doyle is trying to tell us is misplaced here.
Yeah. Except he is a really positive character. True. So, I don't know.
There's so much to this tale. This mystery is so deep. And just as I was thinking that, Doyle wrote it. He said in the text, "A chaotic case, my dear Watson," said Holmes over an evening pipe. "It will not be possible for you to present in that compact form which is dear to your heart. It covers two continents, concerns two groups of mysterious persons, and is further complicated by the highly respectable presence of our friend Scott Eccles." Remember Scott Eccles? Oh yeah. He's in this story too, remember?
Chapter one, Steve.
Right. "Whose inclusion shows me that the deceased Garcia had a scheming mind and a well-developed instinct of self-preservation." So this might have to be a two-parter, Watson. You should make this a two-part story.
You could imagine this even being developed all the way into a novel. It's easy to picture, right?
And in fact, I think as we were reading it and discussing it, these were the notes. It could have been a novel. It certainly could have been spread out and expanded upon. Or as we would call it today, a Netflix series.
Yes. Right. This would make a much better Netflix series than a 2-hour presentation. We've talked about this so many times. A 2-hour Stephen King movie falls flat. You need air. You need space. This is one of those stories that needs more time to develop because there's so much to it.
Including this sort of return at the story's very end to the white cock, the pail of blood, the charred bones in the kitchen of Wisteria Lodge, and the connection to voodoo. So what do you make of ending all these things going on? The dictator, the respectable Scott Eccles, the kidnapping plot, the assassination, all of these sort of moral conundrums of this story. We end with voodoo and its connections to the grotesque.
It is definitely Doyle writing thematically. He started with grotesque. He ended with grotesque in very much a Peabody style ending. Well, there's your grotesque that I told you about at the beginning, Watson.
Well, and yeah, the final lines. "So you see, our savage friend was very orthodox in his ritual. It is grotesque, Watson," Holmes added as he slowly fastened his notebook. "But as I have had occasion to remark, there is but one step from the grotesque to the horrible." He closes his notebook. We close the page. The end. Right? And so it's this notion, I think, of like criminality as a sort of everything looks symmetrical, but is just slightly off. And what the detective does is figures out, just like the artist, just like the art critic of grotesque aesthetic, figures out exactly how something is just a little bit different than the straight and narrow, than the status quo, than the norm of society.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know enough about voodoo. All of my knowledge of voodoo comes from pop culture, especially mostly from Major League from 1989. So I can't speak too much about voodoo.
Not Bull Durham? Yeah.
There was the voodoo in Bull Durham too?
There was a curse placed on a glove.
There's baseball. I tell you, those baseball players are so superstitious.
All right, so where I think this goes is Doyle, throughout this entire story, starts making a number of assumptions on, race and a number of, and voodoo is foreign too. So foreigners, the race of the people, and their strange ways. And I think that this is an ignorance of sort of how these things play out, and you know, also maybe of the spirit of the times, like a civilized society in a potentially viewed as an uncivilized area.
And I think that he's also, just as we saw in The Study in Scarlet, which of course is published many years earlier, but we just read, there is that notion of the great popularity of the travelogue at this time, right? The exoticization of places outside of England and even outside of Europe. And so I think there's just a great interest in late 19th and early 20th century England to like learn about different peoples in different parts of the world.
The world's just not a world of
fish and chips. Learn would be strong, but representations of otherness are very, very popular.
As they were with Shakespeare writing about exotic lands, this world is totally different from what you experienced. That's good storytelling. If you are telling me a story that is very much like my day, it's kind of boring. My day's kind of boring. But those exotic lands, those different people, they have exciting lives. The grass is always green over there. So this is great. There's so much information in this story. I'm still processing this story, and I hope everybody out there is still with us, listening carefully, reading along with us, and following this tale. We're going to get through some more of these. This has been fantastic. I'm so happy to hear from all of you. Give us a call or a text if you have something to say. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of that feedback from around the world, and go to our dedicated website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com, for all of these conversations all put together. I even put together the stories that we haven't seen yet in there, just in case we get to the entire Sherlock Holmes canon in the next couple of months. Woo! This has been fun. I hope you've enjoyed it. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
Where's my sandwich?